Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2003, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a writer. Shortlisted three times for the Booker Prize, she finally won it 3 years ago with The Blind Assassin. She's produced 11 novels altogether, as well as poetry, short stories and criticism. Above all, she's a storyteller, writing and rewriting her narrative until the final tale emerges, often unsettling, infused with pain, but always peopled by interesting characters. Her childhood was unusual. Her father, an entomologist, took his family for long periods into the forests of northern Canada, where, left to her own devices, she developed her observational skills. Her first novel was published in 1969. Since then, she sold millions, translated into at least 20 different languages. Her latest, Oryx and Crake, is published next month, and an opera of another, The Handmaid's Tale, opened this month at the ENO. "It's an accident that I'm a successful writer," she says. "I'm a serious writer, and I never expected to become a popular one." She is Margaret Atwood. You didn't, I think, Margaret, expect to become a writer at all, did you? You wanted to do all sorts of other things.
I didn't really consider writing much until I was 16, and I've always admired my high school English teacher from the time when I was 15, because when they came to do a documentary on me and said to her, "What was she like in your class?" most teachers would have said, "Oh, she was fantastic. I could see right away she had all this talent." But this woman said, "She showed no particular promise in my class."
I thought there was another teacher who said, "I don't understand a word of it, so it must be good."
That was next year.
But what happened? Did you suddenly wake up one morning and think, yes, writing is what I must do?
Well, my piece of mythology about that is that I was crossing the football field. There was no game going on, wearing a dress that I had made myself in the home economics class, which I can remember vividly. It was a nice princess line with a gold button. And I started writing a poem in my head, and then I wrote it down, and that was what I wanted to do. Apparently, I announced this to my girlfriends in the school cafeteria as we were all eating our paper bag lunches that we had brought from home. This announcement that I was going to be a writer was greeted with stunned silence. One of my friends has told me since that she thought it was very gutsy, because you didn't just come out with something like that. I didn't think much of it. It was just a thing that I wanted to do.
And did you feel that you wanted to do it because you had a lot to say, or you just liked the process of writing? What was it?
Oh, at that age, 16, I think you have a very romantic view. So, no, I wanted to be a writer and work with words, but I also had a version of the writer, probably not right at that age, but shortly after, in which I would go to Paris, starve, live in a garret, drink absinthe and smoke cigarettes and die early, dedicated to my art.
Okay, tell me about your first record for this desert island.
Now, this is the Platter singing The Great Pretender, which takes us right back into the high school gymnasium where we all used to lurch around during dances in the 1950s. And it's also a perfect song for writers because it's about illusionism, and writers, of course, dedicate their lives to making people believe things that aren't factually true.
Platters and The Great Pretender, and we reckon that was round about sort of 55. And there you are dancing in the gym at your high school. Give me a picture of yourself. What are you wearing as you sort of gyrate?
Well, first of all, I would be about 15 at that time, and you had a choice of three different kinds of dances. The sock hop, at which he wore socks. And that was a more informal kind of dance. And the semi-formal, at which he would wear a nice dress but not a really formal dress. And then the annual all-out formal, at which, if you were quite brave, you would wear a strapless, a lot of crinolines, high-heeled shoes, and you got a corsage from your boyfriend.
Mm. So what we're hearing in all of this is that huge memory for detail, which you have, no doubt about it, and it comes through in all of your books. And that gymnasium, well, that school as a whole, and the gymnasium in particular, features in quite a few of your books, doesn't it? Not least the opening scene of The Handmaid's Tale.
Opening scene of The Handmaid's Tale, the gymnasium has now become a retention center in a future dystopia. And it's where people are put before they're allocated to other facilities, as it were.
Mm. But where they're trained for those terrible sexual favors they're going to have to carry out. Well, hardly a favor.
Not exactly a favor. I mean, it's just
an exercise.
Yes, an exercise. If the point of the game is to have children, then that's what you do. Mm. It's an exercise.
Mm. But that school as well is where Elaine Risley in The Cat's Eye goes back to, isn't it, when she's become a famous artist.
Yes, she goes to that school. It was a school that was 50s architecture. It was built right after the war. So we were supposed to be very, very proud of its shininess and newness. We had a principal who was a character in himself because he modeled the entire school on the MacLeod clan of Scotland, he being a MacLeod. This was a publicly funded high school, but he made it in his own image. And we used to have visits from Dame Flora MacLeod and her two bagpiping grandsons. Our motto was the Clan MacLeod motto. He wore the Clan MacLeod kilt. And when I finally went to the Isle of Skye and visited, I believe it's the Castle of Dunedin, and said, "Aha, there's the fairy flag of Dunedin." They said, "How did you know about that?"
But also you knew it because you'd filed it away. Your memory is prodigious, isn't it?
I have to go back and check things. You know, it's like having an attic full of junk, I have to say. And you think that something's up there and you think you know where it is and you think you know what it is, but you still have to go and check it out.
Because things get distorted in among the junk. But is there real junk? I mean, do you remember the jingles from radio ads?
Unfortunately, yes, I do.
Like what, Pepsodent toothpaste? Or?
Oh, use Ajax, the foaming cleanser. Wash the dirt right down the drain. Things like that. I mean, you think, here I'm going to be 90 years old, and this is all I will be able to remember.
Record number two.
This melody is the first piece of music that I ever heard. And I heard it because my father used to whistle it while I was swinging on the swing that he had built in the Quebec North Woods.
Part of the Shepherd's Hymn from Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, played by the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. And memories for you, Margaret Atwood, of your father pushing you on this swing and whistling away. This was in the outback, deep, deep in the Canadian forest.
This would be up in the Canadian forest, what we call the Canadian Shield. And you always hear loons up there, wolves howling if you're lucky. There's bears. You know, it's just as you might imagine. What with the skunks, the porcupines, and the animals all around.
How far away was your nearest neighbor?
We had a village that we could see but not drive to. We went by boat. Gas was rationed. It was the war, so the boat was a little, very small engine motorboat. and my father's lab, which was made out of logs, which he had built himself, he would come home in the little motorboat, maybe about 5 o'clock, and we would go and watch him come in this little boat.
How many months a year did you spend down there?
Oh, at the beginning, when he was working for what used to be called the Department of Lands and Forests, he was a forest entomologist, we would go before the ice was out, and then we would be there all the time. The insects were active. And when it started to snow again, which would be in October or November, mm-hmm. we would go back at this point to Ottawa, where he would write up his research.
So you're at the best part of 8 months of the year.
Yeah, at the beginning. Then that got smaller.
What did you do all day? How did you amuse
well,
yourself?
Well, I had an older brother. He used to take charge of me and teach me everything he knew. Of course, he didn't have other boys at his disposal, so I was it. He had to make the best of me.
You said you lived effectively in an all-male household. What does that say about your mother?
My father was a boy, my brother was a boy, and my mother was a boy, too. Her sisters, before she got married, used to pick out her clothes for her because they claimed she had such dreadful taste. And after she was married, my father did it.
But where did that leave you as a little girl? I mean, did you long for pretty frocks or didn't you care about all of that?
I didn't
sort of stuff?
Know about them. When I found out, then I longed for them. But I didn't get them because my mother, being a tomboy, thought that all I really needed was two dresses. One to be in the wash and the other one that I would wear. And she bought two identical ones. I mean, this was... it's why I then fixated on women's magazines. So this was my interest.
But what it must have meant was when you got back into civilization, as it were, and went to school, and you didn't go to school full-time until you were 12, did you? You must have been a very bizarre creature.
Well, that wasn't how I looked at it. I thought everybody else was... No, I think when I was little, of course, the things that frightened me were not bears and skunks. They were flush toilets and vacuum cleaners.
But it's interesting that you were two people. And again, this is one of those academic points. But as someone who's studied, I think, in 78% of British universities, you'll be used to these kinds of observations, which is that there's a lot of duality in your books. You are two people or were
two. Oh, at least two. But
more so than most of us. We all have an innermost, but yours was...
I think so. It was also, I have to say, a Canadian way of being at that time, because my father, who was a very, very good woodsman, would then come back to the city, and away would go the growth of beard and the sort of smoke and cinders and things that he had accumulated, and next day he would be putting on his dinner jacket and going off to some function. You didn't feel stuck in one identity. You simply felt that you had different capabilities.
Record number three.
Record number three. Toronto didn't have an opera company when I was growing up in the 50s. But my father always used to listen to the Metropolitan Opera on the air. And we had one of those opera and concert guides in which all the plots were written down. So I used to read that with great interest. And one of the first things I ever wrote and performed in and directed was a home economics opera. It was about three fabrics called Orlon, Nylon, and Dacron. So there were songs about the compositions of these fabrics and whether they shrank from washing and things like this.
Anyway, this is Mozart.
Mi tremo un po' col cuore.
La ci darem la mano from Mozart's Don Giovanni, with Bo Skohus as the Don and Nuccia Focile as Zerlina, with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and Chorus conducted by Sir Charles Mackerras. And you say, Margaret, if you could have sung, you would never have written. Is that right?
I don't think I would have bothered.
What sort of singer would you have been?
That kind.
Ah.
If I could have been an opera singer or a country and western singer, either one.
But I suppose you did the next best thing in that you wrote poetry and you performed it out loud, did you not?
I did begin doing that in the coffee bar scene, which sprang up in Toronto in about 1960. Everything had changed by then. We were no longer doing crinolines and big frilly skirts. We were now doing black sweaters and leotards and very heavy black lines around our eyes, and we were listening to Joan Baez, and we were doing poetry in coffee bars.
And you had candles in Chianti bottles and were very cool.
We had one of these outfits, and it had the checkered tablecloths, and all the walls were painted black, and it had the first espresso machine, which was worshipped like a god. And unfortunately, the doors of the toilets opened right onto the main room where you were performing. So I had baptism by fire. I would be reciting my plangent verse and someone would flush the toilet, open the door. And you just had to breathe through it.
What a horrible thought. But eventually, if we spool on to your mid-20s, you then hit an astonishingly creative time, don't you, when you're churning out poetry like Madeline, but you're also writing your first novel, or the first one that was going to be published, and beginning others. I mean, where did all that suddenly come from?
Well, I had written one that luckily never did get published while I was working in a market research company in Toronto and getting engaged and then getting disengaged. And then I went to England, and I ended up living in a flat in Kensington with a friend from Toronto who was studying modern dance. And that was when I started writing things that were shortly to become published and that I was finally satisfied with.
Mm. But where was the inspiration coming from? Can you possibly describe it?
I don't know. If you've been working for, by that time, you know, 8 years, as I had been, think of that as piano practice. And then finally one day you can play.
And you've always played both, i.e. you've done the poetry and you've done the novel. Does one feed the other, or is one dominant?
I believe so. I believe it's different parts of the brain. And that if you wired up a poet at the moment of composition and you wired up a novelist who is writing a novel, different parts would light up. And I think that the poetry part is closer to mathematics and music, and that the novel part is closer to the part of your brain that does daily conversation and what we fondly think of as thought.
Record number four.
The next record is by an English folk singer called Cynthia Goodings. Folk singing was very important in the early 60s, and it was also very interesting to me because all of the plots of folk songs seemed to be lurid and to involve drama, tragedy, and murder. And this song is called Mary Hamilton, and it's from Scotland.
As they came into Glasgow town, the city for to see, the bailiff's wife and the provost's wife said, "Ach, and alas for thee. You need not weep for me," she says, "you need not weep for me, for had I not slain my own sweet babe."
Mary Hamilton, sung by Cynthia Goodings. A lot of darkness in there, as you said. We're coming to your darkness. But just tell me first of all about the actual practice of writing. 11 novels you've written across, what, 45 years of writing. That implies, well, it's not many, it implies a lot of honing and polishing, is that right?
A lot of honing and polishing. People are getting to the point where they say, "Oh, but you're so prolific." And I say, "Well, stretch it out."
Well, you write other stuff as well. But I get the impression those novels go through and through and through, don't they?
Well, I write very quickly when I begin. And I always begin with handwriting because I never learned to touch type. I didn't go into typing because in typing were all the girls with very thin eyebrows and they wore their boyfriend's black leather jackets and ankle bracelets. I was terrified of them. They smoked in the washroom. And remember, I was a midget when I went into high school. I was only 12. How did I get into this? I have to start in handwriting.
But it's more than that, isn't it? Because when you go through, when you're honing, presumably you lose whole characters. One feels that the book then comes through.
Characters, I lose plot sections. I change the names of characters. And sometimes I don't finish. I have a couple of novels that I got quite far into that just didn't work out, so I had to abandon them.
And why didn't they work out?
The first one didn't work out because there were too many people in it. And the second one didn't work out because there were too many timelines in it.
So you pressed the delete button on them.
Well, I did, yes.
But what about the timelines? You say you've dumped one because it had too many timelines. Your view of time, which is rather like, I think you've said, rather like liquid shapes, liquid bricks, I think of them as, and you can look down through this liquid into deep, deep into the murky past, and things can rise to the surface through it.
They can do, but they're always changing because you yourself, you the person who has lived in the time, you have been changed by the time. So that when you're looking at an event that happened when you were, say, 10, when you're looking at that event and you're 18, you will remember it one way. When you're looking at it and you're 48, you will remember it quite a different way. So it's very fluid. It's always changing. It's not set the way you often think of it as being set in history books.
Record number 5, tell me about that.
Record number 5. Ah, this is a Goldberg variation played by Glenn Gould. This piece was a piece that my roommate in Kensington, who was studying modern dance, used to practice to. She was doing a modern dance to it. And she finally went and performed it in Wells Cathedral, an event at which I was present.
The aria from Bach's Goldberg Variations, played by Glenn Gould. The Handmaid's Tale, which has now become an opera, is set about now, but in Massachusetts, which resembles a kind of Tehran. The president has been assassinated, a religious dictatorship has taken over, fertile women have become breeding machines, doled out, as you said, to the kind of male elite like a company car. But you can tell me, can you not, that there is no rule obtaining in that awful place that has not existed somewhere in the world.
That's correct. Every single detail, including everybody pulling on the rope when they were hanging somebody so that no one person got the stigma of being the executioner, all of those things have happened.
The bag on the head?
That's from Canada, 19th century, the white bag on the head. You'd think it would be black, but it was in fact white.
The women having to have a husband's permission for abortion.
Oh, they've eliminated abortion. That doesn't happen anymore.
But men controlling entirely the female
breeding.
All
you have to do is go back about 100 years, and you will find that all of those rules were there then.
But this is all about more and worse than that. This is rape being punishable by death at the hands of the mob.
That's existed too. I mean, all of these things have happened, including the color coding of the clothing. All you have to do is go to the sumptuary laws in Italy and who could wear what, you know, who could wear fur, who could wear red. In Rome, only the aristocrats wore the Roman purple.
Your handmaid wears red.
She wears red.
The ghastly aunts who control this regime.
They wear blue. Oh, no, they wear green. The aunts are the headmistresses from hell. And they wear green.
I say.
The wives wear blue. to denote their purity.
And the birth rate is down because of AIDS, because of ecological disaster. We know that all these things have happened, are happening. So these news stories kept cropping up, did they? And you clipped them out, kept the cuttings, and thought, I've got to write this book.
Some of the things happened after I had published the book. For instance, the well-known Baby M case, which was the first surrogate mother case. But surrogate motherhood goes back to the Bible.
The other thing that happened after you wrote this book, because you wrote it, I think, in 86, 85, 86.
84, a symbolic year.
Yes. But then the Taliban came along.
Yes, it did. Islamists would say they deeply misinterpreted the real message of the Quran. But they had people shut up. You had to cover up your windows so that nobody might catch a glimpse of you from outside. They couldn't have jobs. They couldn't be on the street by themselves without a male relative. So widows were essentially just out of luck. No, they couldn't go out and buy food. They couldn't. It was really, really dreadful.
I know you're not supposed to ask writers what their message is on the basis that if we haven't understood it from what you've written, then, you know, we don't have any right to know. But I have to say, you know, a lot of people will be asking after seeing this opera, what are you saying?
Well, let's go back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the social contract. Not very good for women, again, but what he did say was don't ever combine religion and the state, because if you do, you will have the most amazing dictatorship.
So you're saying watch out, be vigilant.
Be vigilant. He said that too. He said democracy is the hardest form of government to sustain.
Record number six.
Record number six is Lottie Lenya, the very famous and wonderful Lottie Lenya, singing Alabama Song from this strange piece by Bertolt Brecht, which I would love to see performed, but never have seen it.
Lotta Lenya singing Alabama Song from Bertolt Brecht's The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, words by Kurtweil, of course, and that was recorded in 1929. Margaret Atwood, if you were prescient in The Handmaid's Tale about the Taliban, we have to hope you're not prescient in your latest novel, Oryx and Crake, which is about a kind of scientist's paradise project that goes horribly wrong. Are you going to tell me there's a factual basis for this scenario as well?
Everything in the book is backed up by our large research file, which is kept in my cellar, and it is called the Brown Box.
What's in the brown
all
box?
In the brown box.
Luminous green.
Well, the luminous green rabbit. We already have the luminous green rabbit, and we already have the spot guider, which is a goat which has spider silk incorporated into its milk, very useful for making bulletproof vests. And we have a number of the other things well on the way.
Genetic engineering is
a lot of engineering of various kinds. But let me say right here that science is not the enemy. Science is a tool. What is done, however, with science is driven by human fear and human desire. So we wouldn't invent things if we didn't have a desire for them or a fear of the things that they are invented to combat.
Mm. People used to say that you were, all sorts of phrases, like the high priestess of pain and so on. Certainly there was a lot of pain and agony and grief in your books and missing children and friends who turned out to be awful enemies and so on. But now there's darkness. There's an awful lot of darkness. And one has to say, where does that come from someone who would seem to be actually pretty balanced and reasonable and had quite a happy life, dare I say?
Yes, I'm a balanced, reasonable person who has had a happy life. And there's quite a few jokes in my books.
Sure.
And sure, she says dubiously.
Well, yes, except that you are left with this, as at the end of The Handmaid's Tale, it's awful, it's just chilling, and you don't know. They are very open-ended, your books. You don't know.
I write them to the point at which I don't know. And people then say to me, well, what happens next? And I say, if I had known that, I would have written it. So with Oryx and Crake, I write it to the moment at which I do not know the decision that I myself would make. And that comes simply out of, you know, I suppose being born in 1939 and coming to a reading age around the time of Churchill's memoirs and in 1984 and Darkness at Noon. You know, that was the world that we grew up in then, and it hasn't gotten any brighter. And here is a song that to me sums up that feeling of something coming towards us, something dark coming towards us. And it's by Van Morrison, and it's one of my favorites of his, and it's called Here Comes the Night.
Why can I accept the fact she's chosen him and simply let them be? Whoa, well, here it comes. Here comes the night. Here comes the night. Oh, yeah.
Them, featuring Van Morrison with Here Comes the Night. Do you imagine, Margaret, that a desert island will be the coming of your night, the darkness?
I'm probably better equipped than some to live on one because I'm used to being alone. I grew up in a place where there was quite a lot of space and emptiness. And I'm good with a pocket knife.
There is that other you. I mean, I was mentioning earlier on that you know there's a lot of duality in your books. And, I mean, you two are two people, are you not? You're Margaret Atwood and you're Peggy Atwood.
Yes, well, that was the fault of my romantic father who insisted on me being named after my mother. And then, of course, they had to call me something else so that we could be told apart. So I was always Peggy when I was growing up, but here was this other name, ready and waiting for me, which turned out to be my real name. And I could use it to do the writing.
Use it being the operative phrase, really, because it seems to me when you come out here, as you are now, you are Margaret Atwood doing your professional bit. But when you go back home, you're Peggy Atwood. Is she a more frivolous person?
Oh, she does a lot more gardening. Margaret doesn't get to go into the garden much. I think it was Peggy who did the summer camping instructing and was a good canoeist.
So it's Peggy who's going to be better on this desert island.
Peggy would be much better, yeah. Not much use for Margaret on the island, you know, no computers.
Right. But the trouble is we're sending Margaret to the island.
We're sending Margaret. Mm. Oh.
Problem. Last record. Tell me what that is.
Oh, yes. These are Kate and Anna McGarrigle, her two are wonderful Canadian singers. And the song that we're going to play is actually not about Canada at all. It's about the United States, just like The Handmaid's Tale. So here they are singing Talk to Me of Mendocino.
Never had the blues from whence I came, but in New York stayed I caught. Talk to me of Mendocino, closing my eyes I hear the sea. Must I wait?
Kate and Anna McGarrigle singing Talk to Me of Mendocino. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Margaret, which one would you take?
I think I would take the Beethoven, if I could have the whole symphony.
It's the pastoral.
Yes.
Father pushing you on a swing.
That's right.
What about your book?
I would take a book I haven't read all the way through yet, which is 1001 Nights.
And your luxury?
My luxury would be a big, huge vat of Culpepper's rose geranium bath salts. And I'm presupposing some fresh water so I could have it. I could have some of it every, say, week, whenever I got really foul.
Margaret Atwood, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
And thank you. A pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.